All right, we are right now on 37, chapter 37, and I want to start with one comment about something we read last time, which is verse 14, when Jacob sends Joseph off to check on his brothers. He says, the very end says, Me'emek Chevron. He sends him from the valley of Chevron. Okay, do you see that little... that tag at the end. So he sent him from the Valley of Chevron. Now, first of all, it's not really essential where he sends him from. So first of all, it's curious that the text bothers to mention it. And second, Chevron is in the mountains. And the phrase Eimek Chevron doesn't occur anywhere else in the Torah. But in Hebrew, as in English, something that is an Eimek, something that's deep, has both connotations. That is physical depth and spiritual or emotional depth. So the rabbis, seizing on this unique usage, say that what it means is that here, the secret is that here is the beginning of the slavery and redemption that was foretold to Abraham in chapter 15. So that's the depth from which he sent him. It's the depth of, you know, the realization of the promise, not a geographical depth, since there doesn't seem to be a geographical depth. Okay. Now, we already did the guy from Dothan. Remember, he goes and he coincidentally, or through fate or through God, finds the person who happens to know where the brothers are for whatever reason, and I won't go over that again. We're now in verse 18. All right. They saw him from afar. Now, first of all, this is very freighted with meaning. How did they know it was Joseph from far away? The coat. Right. It's very hard to recognize somebody from a distance, even when you're young. I mean, for most of us now, it's actually impossible to recognize someone from a distance and often up close. But then you have to face still difficult, but Joseph is in this flamboyant coat. Whatever the coat is, it's obviously immediately they know it's Joseph, which already tells you that the envy is festering. And by the way, that phrase that they saw something merachok is not an unfamiliar phrase to somebody. Remember, all these resonances are going to come to someone who reads the Bible over and over and over and over and over again. The most famous usage of this is when Abraham sees the place merachok from afar when he's taking Isaac to the sacrifice. And the same thing happens to Joseph, of course, that happens to Isaac, which is he is intended to be killed, and in the end, he's saved, right? So they see him merachok, and before he came close, yikrav, and a sacrifice in Hebrew is what? Korban, a drawing close, right? Isaac is about to be a sacrifice. Before he became a sacrifice, before he drew close to them, they conspired to kill him. Which, you know, we know this story, but you can imagine how shocking it is to read this for the first time, that actually they're not just going to rough him up a little bit. They conspired to kill their brother. And so far, it doesn't distinguish between any of them, which means presumably that all of them conspired to kill their brother. And one said to the other, here comes the dreamer. So, and the contempt that drips from that phrase, right, you can feel here at the distance of thousands of years that the dreamer is obviously is Joseph, and what they hate about him is not just the father's favoritism, but his own grandiosity, which is particularly noxious in a younger brother, which remember he was for many of them. And then it says, Ve'ata. Now, those of you who have the Hebrew text, if you look at verse 20, do you see there's a little line after Ve'ata? That suggests a pause, right? It's like Ve'ata, and now. And the reason I think, although I haven't seen this in the commentators, although everything that you think is in some commentator somewhere is just a function of not having found it yet, but my assumption is the reason that pause is there is to let you know something important, which is the action that is about to follow is not impulsive. They stopped and they thought about it. This is not a crime of passion, right? This is a deliberate and deliberated attempt to kill their brother. despite the one or two people, as we'll see, Reuven and Judah, who tried to change that plan. For the other brothers, it's not that their blood was quickened and they got excited and they killed him and then they would have been full of regret. They had paused and thought about it and plotted, and it even says, you know, Vayinaklu in the previous verse, they conspired to kill him. This, in other words, required some planning because they have to figure out how are we going to kill him without people knowing that we're going to kill him. And obviously the plan is you strip him of the coat, you kill him, you throw him in the hole in the ground, and then you bring the coat back and say, oh, he must have been killed by a wild beast. Which also, by the way, has nice metaphorical resonances, because he was killed by a wild beast had he been killed by the brothers. Just not the kind of wild beast that, you know, that they were intending, that they intended Jacob to understand by that. Okay. Ve'ata, and now, let's kill him and throw him in one of the pits, and we can say a savage beast devoured him. And we'll see what becomes of his dreams. So, again, remember the implausible but very clever interpretation of Hirsch, right? Which tries to get the brothers off the hook. I have another way of getting the brothers slightly off the hook in a minute, which is, remember, the agenda of a lot of commentators. They don't want the brothers to be quite as guilty as they obviously are. So Hirsch tries to get them off the hook by saying they knew Joseph's dreams were prophetic because they happened twice, and prophetic dreams occur twice, Pharaoh's dreams and so on. And they didn't want Joseph to be a dictator, which is what it seemed like he would be, a dictator not only to the brothers, but then to the world, because the sun and moon and stars bow down to him. And because Israel was brought into the world to revolt against the omnipotence of human beings and not to be a dictator, they thought by killing Joseph, they were actually preserving the original mission of Abraham to prevent people from ruling the world. So actually the brothers thought they were doing something good. Now, I repeat it again because I think that it's brilliant, even though it's really, you know, every now and then the Torah Tumimah, who is one of the commentators, has, after one of his interpretations, the following abbreviation, Dalid, Vav, and Kaf, and it means Dochek Tzat, which means it's a little forced. He says, well, it's like he gives the interpretation, but he wants you to know he knows, just like you do, that it doesn't fit for us. So this is way forced, but it's still... It's smart and it's admirable that he thought of it, even though probably isn't true. But a verse like this can support Hirsch if you read it Hirsch's way, which is, we'll kill him and then you'll see his dreams won't come true, his bad dreams of world domination, right? Of course, Hirsch's point is they misunderstand Joseph's dreams, but it's an honest misunderstanding. Okay. Now, here's, you know, I don't like this translation because they take liberties here that I don't think they should. But it says, Reuven heard, and then it says, Vayatzilehu miyadam, which means he saved them from their hands. But that's not how they translate it, at least in JPS. It says that he tried to save them from their hands, but that's not actually how the Hebrew reads. It says he saved them, and we'll get into that difference in a minute. He tried to save them is an interpretive translation, okay? Because it may be, in fact, that he did save them. It depends how you read the text. What does Stone say? He saved them?
Reuven heard and he rescued him from their hands.
Right, okay. So I think I like Stone's translation better. Reuven heard and rescued him from their hand. It has more fidelity, but okay, whatever. The translators are traitors. Or as Bialik said, to read something in translation is like kissing someone through a veil, right? I don't know how he knew that, but but I guess. So, okay. He said, let us not take his life. And remember, what position does Reuven occupy in this family? He's the oldest, right? He's the oldest. So when he says, let us not take his life, it carries more weight, right? Because he's the oldest brother. All right. Reuven said, shed no blood. Cast him into the pit out in the wilderness, but don't touch him yourselves, intending to save him from them and restore him to his father. So we know not only what Reuven did, but also what Reuven intended to do, which it doesn't exonerate him exactly, but it certainly puts him in a much, much better light than the brothers who want to kill him. And there's a lot of discussion about what Reuven's intentions were here, since, as we know, Reuven and his father did not have the best relationship. Remember that Reuven sleeps with his father's concubine, handmaiden. What's that? Well, however you define her. So, but having said that, it's nonetheless true that Reuven seems to be the one brother who has some sense of responsibility towards Joseph thus far. That changes a little bit. When Joseph comes to his brothers, what's the first thing they do? They strip him of his tunic. And then it repeats the ornamented tunic that he was wearing, which I assume that repetition is to let you know, even though I think the reader would know that anyway, to let you know to say emphatically that the second motivation, remember the first one is his dreams, that the second motivation, which is his father's favoritism, was noxious to them too. So it wasn't only the dreams, it was the fact that his father gave him this tunic, which was a sign that he loved him more. And so the first thing they do is strip him. Also, obviously, they're stripping him for a strategic reason, which is that they wanted to then use the tunic to show that he was torn by a wild beast. So they took him and they threw him into the pit. The boar was empty. It had no water. Here again, the repetition suggests to the rabbis that it's all you have to do is say it's empty, right? Empty implies that it has no water. Because it says it has no water, immediately Rashi, followed by almost all the commentators, says, but it does have scorpions and snakes and, you know, all sorts of things that could do him harm, which is why it says it was empty, it has no water. But and if that seems implausible to you, then all I can say is we don't live in a country where there are random holes in the ground. It's actually very plausible that there were snakes and scorpions and so on that lived in a desert climate in a shady place, which is a deep hole. Remember that the hole's got to be deep enough and wide enough that Joseph can't climb out on his own. Otherwise, it serves no purpose to throw him in it. So that's a pretty deep, wide hole. That was one of the things, not to weary you with Haiti, but that was one of the things at the orphanage that just struck me, was there's a well there. And the kids lower the bucket into the well to get water. And I don't know about you, but in Philadelphia, where I grew up, there were very few wells on the streets of Winfield. And it reminds you, first of all, how recent is the disappearance of such a world. And how reading the biblical stories, this is part of the professional deformation of being a rabbi. I see a well and immediately I think, you know, biblical stories. But it tells you how different the biblical story is if you live in a world in which it's not, you know, a movie set, but actually the way people live. Which is why, you know, all the great scenes, like the love scenes with Eliezer and Rebecca and so on, happen around wells, because that's where everybody gathers, because that's where all the water is. Everybody has to go where the water is. So in a place where there are deep holes, the first thing you think is there water in there? And if there isn't, then things are going to live in there, because why waste a good hole? It's deep and it's dark and it's, you know, hospitable to creepy, crawly life. Which also means, by the way, that throwing him in there was done with an indifference to his fate. If not, even if it wasn't an attempt to kill him, it was at least an indifference to his fate. So they throw him into the hole, and Reuven intends to restore him to his father. When Joseph came up to his brothers, they stripped him of it, and I'm sorry, there was no water in it, and then they sat down to a meal. Now this, I think, is a great scene, okay? It's really quite wonderful. Let's kill our brother, now let's eat. And it speaks of the degree of callousness. Also, the meal is going to serve a strategic purpose, as we'll see in a minute, but it speaks of the degree of callousness that the brothers felt towards Joseph, or that they felt in general. And remember that these are the same brothers who in Shechem slaughtered all these people. So they're not unused to killing people. And as we know from crime fiction, if not from crime fact, the first murder is the hard one, right? By the time you've done a couple of murders, so, right, exactly. As we all know, by the time, right, by the time you've killed your third person, the fourth person is not a big deal. Well, look, I don't know about you, but in every Agatha Christie book that I ever read, and I read far too many to allow me ever to be a scholar in anything else, the guy always has to kill someone to cover up the first murder, which is what confuses you in the first place. And by the time he does that, so then he kills the third and the fourth and the fifth before Poirot figures it all out. But that's because after you've killed someone, so you realize, if I can draw a bad analogy, it's like during the years in which I didn't keep kosher, I still remember the first time I had a steak, right? And I was amazed to discover that it tasted like a steak. You know, I don't know what I thought. And also, when I finished taking the first bite, there was no lightning bolt, there was no heart attack, and my father didn't leap out of the shadows and say, "I saw you." And that, it's that first, it's that initial, whenever you do something that's taboo, right, it's the first time you do it that vaults you over the, so Shimon and Levi, and then followed by the brothers, they've already killed lots of people. So killing Joseph is not as horrendously awful for them as it would be for people who never killed. I'm assuming. I mean, I don't know. But that's how, yeah, that's right, exactly. In my vast experience with fratricide. Okay, looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Now, this is something that we're going to deal with more tomorrow. I'm going to stop in a couple minutes to take comments and questions. This is something, I'm not tomorrow, next week, we're going to talk a lot about the sale of Joseph, because the sale of Joseph is very confusing and doesn't make sense. But I just want to say a couple of words about it now before we have a conversation about everything up to now. So they sat down to a meal. Looking up, they see a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, their camels bearing gum, balm, and laudanum to be taken to Egypt. Now, according to the commentators, again, why does the Torah have to mention what they're carrying to Egypt? Even though it's kind of neat for us to think about what they're carrying to Egypt, the answer is that this was God's way of taking care of Joseph. When he was carried to Egypt, he was carried to Egypt along with all these spices so that the way wouldn't be quite so, you know, it wouldn't stink as much and it would be more pleasant and his journey wouldn't be awful to Egypt. Take that as you will, but still. Judah now steps up and says, "What do we gain by killing our brother and covering up his blood? Let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, but let's not do away with him ourselves." And then he says, so winningly, "After all, he's our brother, our own flesh. Let's just sell him into slavery as opposed to killing him." But again, it depends on what you think of Judah's motive. This is one of those cases. There are a couple of them in the Bible where what you think of Judah's motive may have more to do with your own experience than with Judah's motive. It's like when Job's wife says to him, "Curse God and die." Some people see that as euthanasia. She's trying to help him. Other people see that as an unsympathetic wife, right? She's trying, you know, it's like, stop bothering me with all, you've brought so much misfortune on me, just die already. And here, it could be that Judah thinks this is the only possible way of saving Joseph's life, the way Reuven did. Or it could be that Judah says, "I don't really care about him anyway. We may as well make a profit as opposed to just killing him." And it's impossible to know which is. But since subsequently, in the next chapter, we're going to have a long story about Judah, which seems to break the narrative, right? Chapter 38 stops the Joseph story and gives us a story about Judah and his kids. His child. At least we're supposed to see some kind of arc of growth in Judah. So either way, I don't think we're supposed to think too much of Judah here, right? We're supposed to think he's still a personality in development, which is why we talk about him later, but we'll come to that eventually. Okay, his brothers agreed. When Midianite traders passed by, they pulled Joseph up out of the pit. They sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver to the Ishmaelites, who brought Joseph to Egypt. Okay, let's stop there. And now, several things about this. First of all, the next sentence is important. Reuven returns and sees that Joseph's not in the pit. Okay? So there are two things that are not easily understood and maybe can't be understood in terms of the sequence of events. One is, as we'll see next time, that it's impossible to untangle who actually sells Joseph and who carries Joseph across the desert and how he gets sold, because there's a confusion between the Ishmaelites and the Midianites and who picks him up and who sells him to whom. But second is, it's not clear what happens with the brothers. It sounds like, first of all, that the brothers conspire to kill him. Reuven has this plan to save him. Judah puts him in the pit either to sell him or to save him or to make a profit, whatever Judah's motivation is. Then Midianites come along. Reuven goes back to the pit with the intention of saving Joseph, and Joseph is gone. But if that's true, if it happens that way, then his brothers didn't sell him into slavery, right? What happened was they put him in a pit, and he was taken by these Midianites who happened to come along. And all they're left with is Joseph's coat, which they then apply blood to and bring back to their father and say he was killed. But in fact, they don't know what happened to him. All they know is he's gone. So when they say to their father he was killed, they might think they're telling the truth. It's conceivable, right? They might not be lying to their father. They might really think Joseph is dead. And that's one of the reasons why it's literally impossible for them to recognize Joseph when they see him years later, which is one of the mysteries of the story, right? As improbable as it is that Joseph would be on the throne, if they knew he was alive and sold to Egypt, how come one of them didn't say, you know, that guy, it's crazy, but that guy looks a lot like Joseph, right? But if they thought he was dead, then, you know. And I mean, there obviously the commentators have all sorts of, he had a beard and royal robes and so on, but still. It's possible that they honestly didn't know that that was true. Obviously, the motivation and, but the other possibility is in verse 26, when they say, what do we gain by killing our brother and covering up his blood, right? It's possible that, because remember that in verse 24, they throw him into the pit. Now, if they wanted to kill him, why do they throw him into the pit? So they throw him into the pit, then they talk about killing him, and then the Midianites pull him out of the pit. So it sounds like here's another possible sequence to play with. The brothers come along, they're going to kill him, but then actually he appears, and it's a lot easier to talk about killing your brother than to actually kill your brother. So they throw him into this pit, sort of uncertain about what to do, and maybe they're going to sell him into slavery. And then Judah says, why should we kill him? Now, why does Judah bring up the killing him again? Because who's not there? Reuven isn't there. And maybe when Reuven goes to check on Joseph in the pit, and the influence of the older brother who wants to save him is gone, they've started to talk about killing him again, right? Because we all know that if there's one person who's influential and that person disappears, it's like a parent who leaves, right? And older brothers function that way, so now the kids can talk about killing Joseph again. But the one saving grace, if there is one, is if the brothers were really intent on killing him, then there is no reason for them to throw him into the pit in the first place. They would just kill him as soon as he appeared, and they don't. So there's a mixture of motivations, and the one other point that I want to mention is that the two, here, turn to, well, you don't have to turn, but I'll turn for you. to chapter 25. Just listen to me for 1 second as I read chapter 25. Abraham took another wife whose name was, anyone know what the name of Abraham's second wife was? Keturah. Very good. Just pleased. She bore him Zimran, Yokshan, and she bore him a lot of kids, okay? The descendants of Midian were, and Midian was one of the kids that Abraham bore with Keturah, okay? So what does that mean when the Ishmaelites and the Midianites come along to sell Joseph? They're all his cousins. Joseph is sold into slavery not only by his brothers, but also by the rest of his family. It makes more poignant the story when you know that not only the Ishmaelites, whom you recognize, obviously, as Abraham's son, but so are the Midianites from Abraham's son. What's that?
They knew each other.
I doubt they knew each other, but they may, look, in the ancient world, you may have recognized the tribe, and so he certainly knew they were Midianites, even if he didn't know that it was, you know, Irving from Midian. So, what's that?
Could they have some seal on their body,
I assume that how they dressed and how, like we talked about the Haredim last time, that small nuances in dress let you know who's a Midianite and who's, because I'm sure that there was some distinguishing characteristic. I don't know. It's possible. Tattoos, I mean, are ancient. So it could be that they have a mark on their face or on their, like tribes do in Africa. Who knows? I don't know. I'm sure, well, I shouldn't say who knows. I don't know. There may be others who have some idea of what Midianites, you know, of what Midianite fashion, right, what Midianite fashion was in the ancient world. The last thing I want to mention is that when Reuven sees that Joseph's not there, what does he do? He tears his clothes, right? Which is an ancient sign of mourning, as we know, and survives in Kriya today, right? When we wear a Kriya ribbon, or you tear the jacket that you're wearing when you hear about the death, and that's obviously an ancient one, but it has a special poignancy here because it's Joseph's cloak. And their envy of what Joseph gets to wear that leads Reuven to tear what he's wearing. So this story has a lot of interweaving, and we'll talk more about that when we come next time to the sale of Joseph. I don't know whether to read this. Well, I'll read this to you. This is kind of a nice, in Nechama Leibovitz, you know, I've mentioned them before, in her study of the sale of Joseph, which, as I said, I'm going to talk about more next time, she has a letter quoted in Luzzatto that says as follows: they moved away from the pit, these are the brothers, so they didn't have to hear Joseph's cries, right? While they were eating, they caught sight of an Ishmael caravan, and Judah said, "What profit?" In other words, it was the caravan, according to him, that stimulated Judah's thought of profit. It wasn't just that Judah all of a sudden occurred to him. It was when he saw the traders, which makes perfect sense, right? It's like, you know, you don't actually want the slicer and dicer, but if you're watching QVC, so all of a sudden you need it. They all agreed, there's nothing new under the sun. They all agreed that as soon as they finished eating, they'd haul Joseph out of the pit and sell him to the Ishmaelites. But why should that disturb their meal? While they were talking, the Midianites passed by quite by accident, took him and sold him for 20 pieces of silver, a symbolic number for those of you who know your New Testament. God, if you don't, just trust me. Reuven, unseen by them, rushed to the pit to haul Joseph out, return him to his father before his brothers would have the chance to sell him. But Reuven was stunned to find the pit empty, rent his garments, and was convinced that a bear or a lion had dragged him out of the pit alive and devoured him in his lair, since there were no traces of bones or blood. Possible. They already had the coat, right? They already had the coat, conveniently. He forthwith reported, the same person who translated Nechama Leibovitz translated our old prayer book. He forthwith reported to the brothers what had happened, and they believed him. Reuven blamed himself for the tragedy, since it was he who suggested casting him into the pit. Right? So even though Reuven was trying to save him, and this is what leads to the kind of translation of he tried to save him, even though he tried to save him, now he ends up blaming himself because had they not thrown him into the pit, he wouldn't have been eaten by the beast. It's all, I mean, it's not that he says this is certainly it, but it's a plausible reading. The brothers thought up the idea of dipping the coat in blood to protect Reuven and convince the father that Joseph had been devoured by a wild beast. None of them went in search of Joseph because they were fully convinced he was no longer alive. Right? If the Midianites had pulled him out, they might have gone after him and said, hey, that's our brother. You owe us 20 pieces of silver. Right? You can't just haul him off. You know, he's our property. Reuven kept quiet on hearing Judah's suggestion to sell Joseph because he thought he'd be able to rescue Joseph from the pit unseen by them before they implemented their design. In other words, before they did what they wanted to do. Now we can understand why the brothers didn't react to Reuven's news that the child is not by saying, we sold him, which they don't do in the next verse, since they knew no more of his whereabouts than Reuven himself. This explains Joseph, I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, which is what Joseph says later when he's on the throne, when he talks to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh says, you know, how'd you get here? And he says, I was stolen from the land of the Hebrews. He doesn't say I was sold by my brothers. Now, usually commentators say the reason he doesn't say that, he doesn't want to be ashamed in front of Pharaoh. You don't greet someone and, you know, immediately parade all the skeletons in your closet. But this is a different explanation, that in fact he was stolen from the land of the Hebrews. The discrepancy, and then he goes on to the discrepancy about the buyers and the sellers. But it's an interesting read and a different read from what we usually assume, which it doesn't exonerate the brothers. Obviously, they plan to kill him. They threw him into a pit. But it makes them less culpable. They actually never sold their brother, and they never tried to kill their brother. Now, last point before I open, I know I keep saying that, but I really mean it this time, is that the charge that the brothers sold Joseph, remember I mentioned that Judas sells out Jesus for 20 pieces of silver as well in the New Testament. The charge that the brothers, what's that? 30 pieces of silver, right, in the New Testament. The charge that the brothers sold Joseph for 20 pieces of silver, that Judas sells Jesus for 30 pieces of silver, this, both of them, dogged Jews throughout history. So the commentator might be motivated by an attempt to rebut the Christian charge, which they also, I mean, a lot of Jews did with regard to the New Testament too, but that's a separate issue, to rebut the Christian charge that Jews sold their brother into slavery for 20 pieces of silver. And by the way, for those of you who read Jeffrey Goldberg's blog in The Atlantic, and if you don't, you really should, the other day he quotes, of all people, Glenn Beck, talking again about how the Jews killed Jesus. And puts in a little reminder. He says that the people would just remember that the Romans did it, we'd all be better off. But that episode and the killing of Jesus, it all has Hebrew biblical precedents, right? It's all the stories in the New Testament, not all, but almost all the stories in the New Testament have foundational stories that precede them in the Hebrew Bible, like the selling of Joseph precedes the selling of Jesus. Jesus carrying the cross up the mountain on which he's going to be crucified is the foundational story of Isaac carrying the wood up Mount Moriah on which he's going to be bound. So the reality that the writers of the New Testament knew, I mean, even if they didn't know it consciously, they knew it when they wrote the stories, is what we know, which is that the stories that lock in to stories that are already known to you, that are already deep inside you, are much more powerful than stories that come to you new, which is why when you read the mythology of other cultures, it doesn't generally speak as powerfully as your own, because those stories that are implanted they just have more resonance. Anyway, okay. That's why, by the way, if you ever try to read, like if you try to read the Quran or the Book of Mormon, it's soporific, right? It puts you right to sleep. Because you really need to start, you need to enter the world of any kind of mythology before it speaks to you. Once you do, it can be very powerful, but it's hard to enter that world. Okay, let's stop there. Questions about, yeah. Yeah. That's a really good question, and I don't know I would say, first of all, I mean, I think that it's implausible. And remember, this was a commentator in the Middle Ages. But I don't know what capacity such a animals have to do that. I just don't know. But yeah, I think it's a pretty good question. You know. Yeah.
Three questions. Where did Reuben go? Number two is Judah that says, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites. And then it's Judah that sells Jesus.
And then Judas.
Judas, but it's the same thing. And then the derogatory term for calling Jews in Iran is Jude.
Right, but that's... That's because that's our. It's not because of Judas. It's because Jews are called Yehudim or Jude. Judah is the predominant tribe. Remember that later on in Jewish history, when the Israelites split, and the Northern Kingdom is the 10 tribes that get lost until they find their way to Salt Lake City, right? And the Southern Kingdom is Judah. Judah survives the tribes. You know, when they get destroyed. In 722, they all come down to the south, and that's how we get called Judah, Judaism, exactly. But it may be that Judas is to kick up that thought, but remember also that everyone around Jesus was Jewish, right? There were no Christians around Jesus; they were all Jewish. Jesus was Jewish. Everyone around him was Jewish, except for the Romans. And the other question was, where was Reuven? There are two. The reason I said that the meal was symbolic as well as practical is one, Bechor Shor, who is, a medieval commentator, he says that remember that shepherds can't all sit down to a meal at once. Some of them have to be off watching the sheep. So part of this is to let you know that only some of the brothers were sitting there plotting Joseph's death. Some of them, maybe Reuven among them, was out with the sheep, or Reuven was over finding his way to the hole. We don't know how far away the hole was from where the brothers were, because when you pasture sheep, you cover a large amount of territory. So there are a couple of different possibilities about where he was.
Two questions. Number one, the 20 shekel, is it representing the 20 years that he was away from his father?
It's a nice idea. I don't know. A shekel a year. From Jacob, from Isaac, well, so 20 years. We could do a nice, numerological, we have to trace the 20s. I like that, which is, of course, is half of 40, which is also pretty, and a third of 60, for that matter, so I don't know. Which is half of 120, as long as we should all live. It really makes it very nice, yeah. Right, yes. Well, right. I don't know how many of you remember when we first started the Joseph story. It says, Ela toldot Yaakov, Yosef. These are the generations of Jacob, Joseph, which is an unusual phrasing. And the rabbis list, 20 similarities. I don't know if it's 20. 20 similarities between Jacob and Joseph, among them that they lose their children. And I don't remember if the years are in there, but I wouldn't be surprised. So the parallels between Jacob and Joseph, if you look for parallels, are really remarkable. Among them, I mean, the favoritism, the losing of a child, all of that.
Sure. Where does the story come that the brothers sold him?
Because in broad terms, they do, right? They plan to kill him, and then in the end, he gets sold. So it's almost, stories and phrases arise out of a feel of things as opposed to out of the literal reading of them. So, for example, Sherlock Holmes never says, elementary, my dear Watson. Nowhere in the Holmes stories, yet that's the most, he says elementary, and he says, my dear Watson. He says elementary Watson once or twice, but the phrase that he's best known by, he never says, and that's not unusual. It's like there's a sort of ethos that arises from something that's not actually the same as the story itself. And that's true. I mean, when you, Delilah doesn't cut Samson's hair. You want a good bar bet? Go bet someone that Delilah never cuts Samson's hair, right? She brings in a barber.
a barber cuts Samson's hair, not Delilah. But everybody thinks Delilah cuts Samson's hair, like everybody thinks the story about smashing the idols is in the Bible, right? They just,
there's
a certain, there's a feeling from a story that's more powerful sometimes than the story itself, and it feels like the brothers sold him, even if they didn't actually sell him, especially because later on, they're guilty, right? Remember that later on, it doesn't look like they profited at all. No, they go home empty-handed except for a bloody coat and some sheep, presumably. But later on, the brothers feel guilty, and Joseph says, it's not your fault, you know, so all of that contributes to the, yeah.
I can't help it in your discussion about resonance and how you also said a moment ago, nothing's changed. It's all the
right.
Same. When we read the phrase, and they then sat down to have dinner, it seems shocking.
Yeah.
I recall reading not too long ago that at the end of the day of killing Jews, the German officers would sit around
right.
and sing Schubert leader.
Right. Yeah.
So if that would be my resonance,
right.
if I would tell that story somehow, and the story would change, because I would bring it to a different.
He said that what it brings up for him is the idea of Germans killing Jews and then sitting down to listen to Schubert at the end of the day. That is, there's a, what's that?
They sang the leader.
They sang, or singing Schubert. That there's a disconnect between the savagery of the act and the way that people celebrate afterwards. And I think that that's, I mean, the same thing's true in medieval killing fields and then people sat down to dinner. The other way to see this, I know we don't want to see Nazis this way, but the other way to see this is that this is also what happens in war, and when human beings have done something savage, they need to reorient themselves as human beings precisely because they did something savage. So that might be an indication of their inability to face what they did, I'd like to think so, as opposed to callousness. But it's sometimes interpreted as callousness, but we all know that callousness can be callousness. It can also be a cover for a sensitivity. So at least in the brothers' case, it would be nice to think that the reason they had to have a meal was because they couldn't actually face what they did.
Or
they were hungry. Right, that was the other possibility. Yeah, it's hard work to be a shepherd all day long. It's like, it build up an appetite. Right, yeah. I don't know. Right. Or no, it doesn't say anything about it. I don't know. It's part of what's missing for us is at least for me, is an image of the landscape. I don't know. Are there clumps of trees? Were they far enough away that they actually couldn't see the hole? Because Reuven has to go over to the hole to check. So it may be that it was the equivalent of, you know, half a mile away where they dump Joseph, and then they go over to where more of the sheep are to have the meal. And in the meantime, half a mile away, they don't keep looking over there. The Midianites are, I just don't know. I mean, which is neither here nor there, but what always, the image that is unfortunately implanted in my mind is David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia. You know, and I see him coming out over the, and the hot sun behind him, right? But it may not look like that at all. That's just, you know, although Joseph could have looked as good as Peter O'Toole, because he clearly, right, he was clearly a good-looking guy, and, yeah.
There's no mention in the Torah of Joseph's response.
Nope, not a word. The first time Joseph opens his mouth, one of the reasons why they call him Yosef HaTzadik, Joseph the Righteous One. First time Joseph opens his mouth is to talk about God and the interpretation of dreams and so on. Actually, before that, in Potiphar's house, you know, God wouldn't allow me to do this. Joseph is silent, and it's the silences of the Bible, which are vast silences, that allow so much interpretation and reading into of what Joseph's reaction is. But not a single word does Joseph say, not when they take him. At least, I shouldn't say that. Not a single word is reported of Joseph, not when they take him, not when they throw him in the pit, not when they transport him to Egypt, not when he rises in Potiphar's house. He says nothing, absolutely nothing. So, yeah.
And when they take off his coat, it says, yeah, sheep, and
yeah.
Stuff, like they make him simple. Is that
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. It comes from Pshat. The question is Vayafshitu, when they strip him of his coat. It's the same word as Pshat or Pashut, which is simple. It's like they made him simple, or they made him pure, or they uncomplicated him. I don't know. Vayit Nakel, that they conspired, is a word for complexity. So maybe it's in contrast to their scheming, is his simplicity. Because remember that the Ish Tam, a simple man, is a great praise in the Jewish tradition. Do you know the Quaker hymn, "'Tis a Gift to be Simple"?
Yes.
Great, beautiful. Aaron Copland has an arrangement of that. If you want to hear something truly beautiful, you hear Paul Robeson singing that hymn, "'Tis a Gift to be Simple." It's really beautiful. But that ideal, that Quaker ideal of being simple, is also a biblical ideal. In fact, it says in Kohelet that God made people simple, but they've engaged in too much reasoning. He's talking about Jews, I think. Yeah. 17. Yeah, he's usually thought of as 17. I don't remember what the calculation is, but that's what all the commentators... So he's not a child. He's not a grown-up, but he's not a child. Yeah.
But what is the lesson that this story is trying to tell us? I mean, one of it is, don't show up.
Yeah.
Joseph was showing up. They felt that he was arrogant. Stripping of his clothes is trying to make him humble. Throwing him in the well or in the pit is trying to teach him humility. And is it a message that maybe, especially the Persian community, not show up or don't show up?
You're trying to get me in trouble, aren't you? All right, look, here's what I would say, in all seriousness. So what, I'm not going to repeat the question. He said, is the message of the story not to be ostentatious, not to show off the way Joseph does, and is that a message to us as well? I'm paraphrasing. Here's what I would say. In seriousness, let's actually, because you said about the Persian community, let me say something about the Persian community in particular. It's very common for immigrants to take one of two different tacks. One is to disappear so that people don't notice you, because you don't want to be seen as different and you just want to blend in. The other tack is to be extravagantly and noticeably successful, so that you can prove that you belong here. Both of them are completely psychologically understandable. They make perfect sense. It's not only immigrant communities that do that, so do individuals do that. Both of them have certain dangers and certain perils. So what you want is for someone to work hard, be extremely successful, and not to show off. That's a delicate balance and hard to do. So let's use Joseph as an example. Joseph is obviously extraordinarily gifted young man. He's given these powerful dreams. He's deeply loved. He doesn't have a mother. And for him to show himself as unusual is a natural thing to do, if a dangerous thing to do. And also, everybody knows that at 17 or 16 or 15, you just don't have the judgment that you have. He might not have bragged to his brothers if he'd been 30, but he's 15, you know, and at 15, that's why, I mean, there's a reason why, like, basketball players who are show-offy, a Kobe Bryant, a Julius Erving when I was growing up, there's a reason why they're particularly beloved of adolescent boys. Because they're from Philadelphia, exactly. There's something about that. There's something about that. I mean, and you see it like, and also it has to do with cultural ideals. That is, in sports, that's changed, right? It used to be in sports when you scored, you didn't make fun of the other team. Now you do. But so yes, the answer is, yeah, that's one of the lessons you can draw from. Certainly not the only lesson. But it's, you know, it's Maimonides and Aristotle's idea, which is that everything is a balance. Yeah.
Can we suggest that another lesson is for parents of multiple children to learn to treat them the same?
Well, there's no question about that. Not to treat them the same,
but to treat them so that one isn't favored over the other. Because you can't, if you treat your children the same, you're being unfair to all of them, right? Because children aren't the same. And you don't want to, for example, send them all necessarily to the same school or the same camp or have the same expectations of them. You don't want, when one kid brings home an 80, you want to say, that's great. When the other kid brings home an 80, you say, that's fine, but you probably didn't try your best, right? So,
like if you throw a lavish bar mitzvah for one and you don't do it for the next one.
Actually, it's possible to not do it for either, and that would be even better. But I just want to throw that out there. But yeah, right. No, you can't do it. But obviously, you can't do it for one and not the other. And yes, they what clearly arises from all of the stories of Isaac and Ishmael and Jacob and Esau and the brothers is that the inability of parents to love their children equally, even if they favor in certain characteristics one or the other, that the inability of a parent to show equal love to children is destructive and damaging and has terrible consequences. I mean, it does over and over again. Yeah, Talia. Well,
for any child at that age,
yes, it's a huge trauma.
Yeah.
And
how did he handle all this?
Well, yeah, right. Yes. Well, this goes to, yeah, have you been reading about this book, the book written by Amy Schwa, which has been all over the, right. It's actually reviewed in the New York Times this morning by Janet Maslin, very clever review. The Tiger Mother, right. It's called The Tiger Mother. It's about a Chinese mother whose expectations of her children are very high. Like the child makes a birthday card, she throws it back at her and says, you spent 20 seconds on this. I want you to make me a nice birthday card. I deserve it, right? Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, I mean, it is certainly possible to overestimate the trauma to a child by the fact that they weren't invited to a birthday party. But getting thrown in a pit by your brothers and sold into slavery, that's a trauma. And the way that the rabbis generally handle it is not, this is generally speaking, is not with the same degree of psychological insight that they handle some other things, because their assumption is that Joseph has tremendous unshakable faith and always assumes that God is going to take care of him. And also they see again and again in Joseph's life this pattern of ascent, descent, and ascent. He goes down into the pit, he goes up into Potiphar's house, he goes down into the jail, and he raises up in, and so there they assume that Joseph handles this all with equanimity, especially because Joseph never says anything like Jacob says. Remember what Jacob says to Pharaoh when Pharaoh says, how was your life? Or how are you? And he says, the years of my life were few and bitter. Joseph never says anything like that. In fact, Joseph says the opposite. He says to the brothers, I know you intended it for bad, but actually it all turned out fine, which is sort of, you know, it's giving them a shtuch. It's like, I know you guys wanted to kill me, but here I am, you know, second in command in Egypt. Yeah. And then this last one. Yeah. Right.
And he was maybe taken by his dad to Hebron, so the spirit of Abraham.
Right, we said that at the very beginning about Amek Hebron. Right.
Right. And then Abraham's descendants kind of sealed the deal. The Ishmaelites and Midianite or Medans, so that the spirit of Abraham was maybe behind guiding this, and it goes way back.
Right. Right, that's a nice twist on it. Right, we gave an abbreviated version of that at the beginning, that the Ishmaelites and the Midianites are both Abraham's children, and that the split, but I didn't say anything about the splitting, the Brit Ben Habatarim, which is earlier on when the fire comes and splits the animals in two that Abraham sacrifices, and that's representative of the splitting of the brothers. But the idea that this is the engine that sets all of Jewish history in motion is clearly there, and also in the phrase Amek. So next time we're going to talk about the complications of the sale of Joseph, and
We're going to see if we can finally, it's taken us a long time, we can finally get him into Egypt. All right, thanks very much.